My name is Walt Wongren. The title of the session is changed. I made a mistake. Now, I already told them to change, so they don't have to rush to the label and switch it. But I had said that this would be called The Job of the Author, and it sort of implied that the series of presentations that I'll make during this week, five presentations, would focus on author. And I think that's a mistake. And the first part of what I'm going to do with you is show you the mistake. To me, it is a persistent astonishment that I can call myself an author. It is an astonishing thing, and I never get over it. When I was a child, I wanted to be a writer, and I wrote stories and poetry and all that stuff, college, graduate school, ministry, that by the grace of God, I can make a living by it is more than I ever anticipated. So when I started thinking of the series of presentations I'd like to make to you, I think I focused on myself too much because of this amazement, and I made it too narrow. I don't think it should be the job of the author today, the obedience of the author Tuesday, tomorrow. I think it should be the job of the artist, which is much broader. And much of what I have to deal with this week is not restricted just to words on paper. How many of you are artists? I see one, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight hands. Well, all right, let's shape that. Let's shape that. I will count because we have this tape. We have nameless thousands listening to you right now over the next years. Let's shape that. How many of you have communicated by the craft, that's a significant word, of language to other people? Whoa. Look at this. A forest of hands go up. How many... So you are artists, after all. How many of you have composed music, songs? So you are artists. How many of you... needlepoint. And are doing it right now. So here are more hands. How many weave, knit, and choose colors? And choose colors for it. They become your own choice. Choose patterns. They become your choice. You are editing artists, and then you are crafty artists. How many of you arrange flowers? Plant gardens with the sweet awareness of the beauty or the effect upon the people who pass the garden. How many of you have arranged your home, have furnished the home, and chosen the colors in order to create an atmosphere, which is a crafty activity, with a specific view in mind for what should happen to the people who dwell within that house? Put your hands up. Many. Than and I were going over this last night, and Than made a notation that many of these examples that I was bringing out were what women do more than men. That's right. And so she said, I should ask, how many make cabinets? Yes. But you know that there is a thought behind this, and this is parenthetical, and I'll touch it and then pass on. It is, I think, that women are more inclined toward the artistic role than men, for whatever reason, and find these varieties of ways of being artistic. How many of you have put on a banquet, whether it's in a large hall or in a small house for a birthday party, and have chosen the activities? This is dramatic art. What happens in this banquet? How many of you have chosen peas and carrots because you like the beauty of the orange and the green on a plate, specifically frozen beans, cooked or peas, or fresh peas, not canned peas? Do you begin to see what I'm telling you? Now put your hands up. How many of you are artists? There should be almost all of you who have. And now I move to the definition, and this is part of what we're going to deal with throughout this entire week. Three things, the definition that I want to get at is the definition of an artist, and I think three things at least are involved. I don't have time to cough. I only have 55 minutes and so much to tell you. One, the artist is one who communicates by some kind of a craft, some self-conscious, a craft which has its own intrinsic rules to it. A craft which must be learned. This is still number one. It may be that you learn it by doing it. It doesn't necessarily mean that you go to school. It may be that you learn underneath mentors who were never named as mentors. Somebody taught you how to weave, or somebody taught you how to knit or use needlepoint and so forth and so on. But it was a craft that needed to be learned, and it had its own rules. Number two, the artist is one who uses that communication by a craft in order to effect, E-F-F-E-C-T, experience in another human being or in other human beings. One, craft, its own intrinsic rules. Two, to effect experience. Experience means that you use the senses of the other person, and that by controlling or directing their senses, by giving them images or touch, feel, taste, all those things, you order, you direct, you whisper an experience. And it's an experience that you have in your art already some sense, but not total control over, some sense of what's going to be. That's why flower arranging has something to do with it. Gertrude. Three, the purpose of this experience. And now I have to be a little bit more careful. This is a lengthier part of the definition. The purpose of this experience is not just to represent reality. It is not just to depict reality. I'm going to tell you several things that is not just, although these are a part of it. It is not just to be pleasant or to afford pleasure for other people, although that is part of it. It is not just to instruct or edify somebody else, although that is part of it. Are you all with me still? It's a bunch of stuff. What I just gave you was a quick overview of the history of criticism of art. Because they used to say that what art was for was instruction and pleasure. Chaucer, if I can, I shouldn't start without having in my head, said that the stories were written for solace and high sentence. Solace is pleasure, and high sentence means meaning, instruction, edification. It is not just that, but it is part of that. It is not just, I'm going to add you one more thing, it is not just, for elevation. Not just to represent reality, a picture of reality, although that is part, not just for pleasure, people are pleased to see or experience what you give, not just for instruction, and not just for elevation, which is the ennoblement of the people who watch it, who discover value and how to follow in value, the moral pressure. I bring in number five now. The purpose of this experience, oh, I hope I can say this right, is to become a kind of a womb for all experience thereafter. Let me give you an image. It is the house in which, when you are the artist and I respond to your art, it is as though I enter into your house for a little while. In a certain sense, it is a created house. It doesn't exist. It's not there. I write a story of something that never happened. You enter into the story, you enter in my house. In another sense, it is the very center of the universe, house. It is a place in which I experience, dwell. It is a place in which I dwell so that I may peer out at the rest of reality and all the rest of my experience and find some order in that chaos, because I have dwelt within this cosmos, this ordered experience, for a little while. Now, that does not make it merely consoling. The artist of all people is very often most aware of what is wrong in the world and what is painful and what hurts. But I will say this, I will argue this to my dying day, and I know I will argue against many artists, authors, and poets for it. But I don't think our job is merely to depict or make people experience what is rotten and painful and broken in the world, but to do that in order that we move to some kind of an order, redemption, wholeness, health. But you'll notice that the artist doesn't do it just by sitting down and teaching a Sunday school lesson. The artist does not just put several principles up and then explain them, sort of like I'm doing right now. What the artist does do is effect experience and invite other people into that experience to experience it too. And sometimes they're not even aware of how dynamic this thing is which is taking place. Now, I'm going to spend some time this morning describing that even better and better and better. So if you haven't gotten a hold of it, I have just established the thesis for this first presentation. This is what we do, people. And I was not kidding when I asked you to put up your hands in the various ways in which you do this for others. You don't have to be an author just to do this. All the ways in which those who build houses and are sensitive to the arrangement of rooms and sunlight and heat and warmth, all the varieties that go on in a house, and who may do that by simple instinct and never sit down and ask the aesthetic questions why, mere practical questions, are artists with profound effect upon those who dwell within those houses. Those who arrange cities, consciously or unconsciously, there's much we could say about that, but we don't have time, should recognize that they are artists with profound effect. Most often cities grow by accident, don't they? And become the chaos that we would like to overcome in art. What? All right, let me, a quick overview for the week. This is my thesis. Today I want to talk about what we do. Tomorrow I want to talk a little bit about how we do it. Our times, so these five lectures will not necessarily, you will not have to be at this one in order to understand the next one. And yet, I do see them related to each other. Each one will enrich the other. So if somebody didn't come today and they want to come tomorrow, they will not feel lost. But having come today, tomorrow will be a little bit more rich. And I looked at my schedule and it goes something like this. This morning we meet in the morning. Tomorrow we meet at 6:50 in the evening. On Wednesday we're going to meet at 3:30 in the afternoon. What is this? There's order. I'm imposing order upon chaos here. Thursday we're going to be back at 6:50. And Friday we're going to be at this time again at 10:45. Tomorrow we'll talk about how we do it. Wednesday I'm going to read you a story. And that's all I will do. It'll take a little while in this room, I think. And Potter, I'm going to read you Potter, the story called Potter. Some of you may know it. Thursday we will have an opportunity to take what we talked about today and tomorrow and discuss it with regard specifically to that story, Potter. And I'm going to suggest that any ideas that occur to you during the reading, save them, because that will be our real discussion period on Thursday. And then Friday, I want really to do something I've never done before. I want to show you six poems in a sonnet sequence, which I wrote, and which, because of the form of the poems, became extremely redeeming for me and moved me forward. What do? We, this is we now, all of us, artists. What do? We are Nathan Krager. I have to tell you of something that happened the second last time that I was at our church, at Grace Church. It's a little while ago because I think this was in June, early June this happened, but this really happened. I'm going to give it to you exactly the way it happened. Grace is a small church in Evansville, Indiana. It has 20 pews, that's all, and each pew comfortably holds six adults. So you can imagine its sanctuary really is not bigger than this room, although it would go this way and the pews would all face front. We have a choir. We have several choirs at the church, but we have a choir of little children, which they cutely call the Grace Notes. The bigger choir is called the Sounds of Grace, and so these are the Grace Notes. And on that particular Sunday, I was sitting on the left-hand side facing front, about four pews back, and I saw that the Grace Notes were going to sing because they fill up the first two pews on the left-hand side, and they are a menage of children, most of them black, few of them white. Nathan Krager is white. And they take pleasure in singing. They take pleasure in singing, especially the young ones, the little tiniest ones and so forth. Nathan is a little bit older now and has been in for a little while. And you know they're going to sing by the way in which they sit in the pew. And their time came to sing, and they slouched into the front of the church. Let's make this the front of the church now. The three little girls who were in the front, I won't try to give you their names, stood very sweet. And face the congregation like this, and they always wave by crooking three fingers to the parent, for the break, and that's how the parents respond. You know, they get warm. But and then the older kids, you know, it's up through the eighth grade, slouch against the pulpit like this. So it's a raggedy band getting up to sing. But I noticed a difference on this particular Sunday when the kids came to sing, and that was in Nathan Krager's behavior and his posture. Nathan Krager came and stood, second step up, in the chancel, military. He stuck his chest out and his elbows went back like wings behind him, and he stood absolutely stiff and he stared straight forward over the heads of the congregation like this, and he didn't budge. And this was strange for Nathan Krager. I was immediately aware of something different in this boy's posture and behavior. Nathan has a cascade of hair down the back and generally has a glint of wildness in his eyes, Joseph will remember. Nathan is the one that when you walk downstairs in church, if he sees you, you get out of his way because he can turn himself into a bullet, shoot across the floor of the church and boom his head in. Or if he doesn't get his head in your stomach, he'll jump up and kick you in the kneecap. He's a tough guy to be around sometimes. He's extremely intelligent and he's full of energy and he does not always stand military, erect, and organized, still obedient. He doesn't do that. Sometimes a person might think that Nathan is the way he is because his parents divorced some time ago, and that's not easy. His father has continued to come to Grace, and on that Sunday morning was sitting right in front of me with his girlfriend. His mother was in church that Sunday too. She was sitting across the aisle and back a little bit, flanked by her parents. She doesn't usually come. Maybe she will now. Her mother, Nathan's grandmother, and her father, Nathan's grandfather, were on either side of her. I didn't understand. I didn't understand why they were there. So the choir director began to direct, and the pianist began to play, and the children began to sing. And those three cherubs in the front row, one of which sang strong and sure of herself, the other two sang sweetly and kind of followed the words. You know how children will make their mouth mimic the mouth of the one next to them to make it look like they understand what they're doing, but they're all happy to be up in front. And Nathan stood straight like this. He never budged. I didn't understand what was happening to Nathan. I didn't know why he was standing like that with his cascade of hair on his back, straight, looking dead forward. And then the song was done, and the congregation applauded. They do that at Grace, in spite of the fact that they're Lutheran. Maybe it's because they're black. They applauded, and the children appreciated it, and they all ambled down into the pew, except Nathan. He didn't move. He stood center front, chest out, elbows back, staring over the tops of the congregation, and I understood what the difference was. Nathan Krager had a solo. He was going to sing a solo. I don't remember Nathan Krager singing a solo all by himself with none of the support of the other kids around him. He stood there, and then the pianist began to play, and Nathan began to sing. And it was extraordinary. He hit every note precisely. He never moved. He kept that posture. He took seriously what he was doing. He had a sweet voice right then. And I think there must be four verses to the song that he sang. And the first verse went smoothly. And during the second verse, I saw his eyes start flicking left and right. And I knew that he was aware that he might forget the words. He was not forgetting the words. They were all there right when he needed them. But there was a moment of uncertainty in him when he thought he might. He never broke that posture. And it was as though there came a moment in the second verse where he found the words. And you could see in his face a relaxation. And he sang. He sang so well, I saw his father sitting in front of me put his head down and take his glasses off and cover his face because he was crying. His father was crying, and Nathan had no awareness of this because he was looking over the top of the congregation, singing so beautifully and hitting every note precisely. And by the fourth verse, I looked around at his mother, who was sitting flanked by her parents back to my right, and her head was down. And she was crying. Nathan sang order. Nathan sang sweetness and power and innocence. And his mother and father, in this one moment, were doing exactly the same thing. Nathan sang harmony so deep that I don't even know that they were aware of it. But in that moment, they were Nathan's parents. And in the song, they were one. I don't know if they ever knew that they experienced the exact same emotion when Nathan sang, the same precise experience. It would be nice if they did. But that's as far as the story goes. When Nathan finished his fourth verse, he just stood there and he kind of waited for the applause. But so much of the congregation had been moved, it took him a while to remember that they were black. And in that space of time, before the applause came, Nathan figured out what to do. He bowed. He reminded them, and they applauded. And then he went to sit down. I don't know what redemption is in that story. This is a true story. This, as I tell you, I just saw it happen. It happens all the time. This stuff happens all the time. I don't know what redemption ultimately is in that. I can't tell you, oh yes, and now his parents have gotten together. They won't. They won't. But I think we are Nathan. I think this is what artists do. Or I wish to God that this is what artists did. There was in that moment, in all the chaos that human beings create for one another, and that divorces create, as you can imagine or you know, there was in that moment a harmony and a redemption. That moment at least was redeemed by the child of the broken marriage, calling both a husband and a wife now broken, calling both a mother and a father into a single emotion, in a single expression of love for that child, for that unity. But that has happened twice. I told you the story of Nathan so that you could have a kind of a dramatic image of what I think the artist does. In this case, it wasn't a writer, it was a singer. But I told it to you because I'm the artist. I'm the artist. I just told you the story. I just invited you to come to my church. Do you understand? I just did it. And I made this Grace Church, and I shaped for a little while, I hope, maybe a little bit, each of you at various levels because of your backgrounds and because of your willingness and all the other things it requires of people who listen or respond to artists. I invited you to dwell in my house just a little while. And I don't know what the consequence of this was for you. I really don't, although as Kristen and I were saying, it is an intimate gesture to be an artist. I nevertheless don't know if some of you are divorced or if you might remember these things or what might have spun out of that. And I'm sorry that I'm killing the story right now, but that's what I'm doing. I'm objectifying it. I should just let it float. I should just let you dwell in it. But this is a lecture after all, and I'm talking very fast. I think Nathan, what I have just done is the thing that we do for a little while to order the world. For a little while to people the world with possibilities. Now, there are two things involved in a story like this. I will touch them, and then I will move on. There was accusation. In Nathan's singing, I think that there was accusation, even though a person doesn't recognize it. There was the awareness of sin. But at the same time, there was the possibility, at least in the story, that there may be healing in these tears that can be confessional, that can just be sad, or that can be lonely, but certainly are loving. It's very complicated, complicated. We are the shapers, we artists. The world that either has a lousy shape to it, I mean the real world that people perceive to be the world around them, that has a broken, lousy shapelessness, meaninglessness around it. We shape it for people. It's a profoundly important thing that we do, all of us who are the artists. We are. Now, this is the word that maybe is hard. This is an old English word. The word is translated as poet, shop. You pronounce S-C-O-P, shop, and it's translated poet. Ah, there it is. We are the poets. Dear people, this is what we don't do, and if we think we do it this way, we enter into trouble and problems. We do not. This word poet, as it was defined in the Renaissance period and later on, was defined as the creator, those who create, poietes, those who create. That's the kind of the Greek sense of that word poietes, which has become poet. They love to think of themselves as creating things that had not existed before. I will put this down as an artistic premise for all of us. We are not that kind of creator. Only God is. We do not create out of nothing. We do not create ex nihilo. When I first started as a writer, I think like Alexander, I used to weep because all of the stories had been written. It used to bother me to think that I came so late in the world's history that I could not make up any new stories from scratch. But I was a fool. It's an evil foolishness. It becomes an evil foolishness. because my job is not to create out of nothing. I don't think any of our artistic jobs are to create out of nothing. If we think so, do you know what we end up with? Monsters, monstrosities, grotesques, things that do not necessarily belong in God's ordered creation. That is not what we do, and it was for me a kind of a relief and a blessing and then a calling to recognize I am only the shaper, I am not the creator. God is the creator. That's a significant thing. C.S. Lewis, likewise, rails against those who think that they have to start from scratch melodies that had never been written before or songs or whatever. Because C.S. Lewis implies that when people do that, they open up all kinds of possibilities of evil from the people who respond. I think sometimes, as much as my children will sometimes go see it, I think sometimes that the horror films that are created now and the grotesque novels that come are because people are playing with emotions in such a way that they are going against order and trying to create things that never existed before. That's beside the point. There is an older meaning to the word poet, and I like it better than creator. The old Sanskrit meaning is a piler into piles, a heaper into heaps. That's what I do. I come upon a mess of matches, for example, and I heap them and I pile them until what was already there forms an order. I don't make the matches out of anything. I come upon a mess experience. And that's my experience and it's yours. You come upon a mess of flowers. But something is already there. I don't just mean the material we work with. In my case, words. In your case, color, sound, whatever. Furniture. I don't just mean we work with the materials that are already there. I mean that we work with the things of God or human experience that are already there. And for people who did not know nor experience nor sense the shape, we give it shape. That is the meaning of the old, that's the best meaning of the old English word for poet. The poet is the shaper. I love that. I think that's a holy vocation. I mean that seriously. This is what it kind of implies. When did we start? Half hour ago. Imagine yourself in the Mead Halls, Northern Europe, 6th, 7th, 8th century of this age. Imagine that you live in a building maybe like this one with a high ceiling, except that it comes down on an angle and there's a crack all along the top so that the smoke can go out. We build fires for ourselves, and the fires are not in the center, the fire in a single center, they run down the middle of the Mead Hall. It's called a Mead Hall because we drink mead. Mead is an alcoholic beverage made out of honey. It's the oldest alcoholic beverage in the world. It may, in fact, be the oldest self-conscious beverage of the world. I'm sorry to those who would rather have grape juice and such things, but it's because medu is one of the oldest Sanskrit words in the world, and we learn from the language what the people used to do. They used to drink sour mash honey or whatever. I don't know what. We drink honey. Our life is not particularly romantic. It is relatively dirty. We sleep on hay on the ground, which we clean out maybe once every month. And all the junk and detritus that has fallen into that hay, we keep our battlements on the walls. The lady and the lord of this Mead Hall might have their own compartment off to the top, the chlavard. The word lord means, and I'm telling you more than, but I have 2 days to do. The word lord means the bread giver. Chlavard is the old English word for lord. The loaf verd. The keeper of the loaf is what Lord means, the giver of bread. So there's a sense of community among us, and that community has to do with how we eat. Lady and Lord may have a but we all sleep kind of out in this single, rather gloomy, dim. There aren't much windows. We don't have much windows in here. And we live on a hill, and down the valley and up on the other hill over there, there is another mead hall with another lady and Lord that are in charge of that. And we're worried about the space which is between us, and so every once in a while we have a fight. We meet in the morning, just at sunrise. We get all, and it's not, I tell you, romantic. We don't wear chain mail. We don't have any armor like that. Our armor is it's a blue shirt, or it's hardened leather. Our shields are just wood with a hardened leather. We've got short swords like this, and they're not very sharp. We don't. In other words, we're not Lancelot. Okay. Please, you have to understand that. This is not a romantic era. We go before the sun rises down into the valley to meet the people from the other mead hall. All of this is going to make sense in a little bit. And before we even start to fight, we line up on two sides facing one another. And we scream at each other. Taunt is the word. We taunt each other. We spend a good deal of time in taunt. There's a lot of reasons for that. One is that we're working up our own blood so that we can enter this bloody fight that we're going to go into. It's a little bit like becoming crazy before you do a crazy thing. I mean, we say, I'm going to rip your guts out. And I even believe it when I say it. See, I'm working myself. We're also trying to scare the other side enough. If we can shout louder, more poetic, more violently than the other side, maybe they will quail and run. Likely they don't, because they're shouting at the same time back to us. We are enlarging ourselves as roosters do when they put their feathers out to look really big before we actually... And we may spend most of the morning taunting each other. People still do that. I mean, that's Cold War, and it's politics, and it's elections, and my son Matthew the other day, about a year ago, he rushed. He was watching television, and he rushed into my study. He said, Dad, you got a pencil. And I gave him one, and he got a piece of paper, and he rushed out again. He was watching television. I don't know what he was looking at, but I went into the kitchen then later on, and here was this little slip of paper on top of the television set, and the slip of paper said, I'm going to hit you so hard when you wake up, your clothes will be out of style. Matthew had found a wonderful taunt on television. And he was memorizing it. I mean, you understand, you know, teenagers, especially where we live, you have to know these taunts because you spend most of the time in taunting without... One kind of wishes that generally as nations we spend more time in taunt and less time in blood. Well, you know, and on the streets of the city, that's rapping comes from something called signifying. Signifying is essentially taunting. It's going on. Okay, so we taunt. And then the war starts. The bloody battle starts, and it is not pretty. It's stinking. Remember, we have short swords, and they're not sharp. And that means that we literally see our enemies. We're this close to our enemies, and we're screaming at them, and we're hacking at them, and they're hacking back. And it doesn't go like that, and somebody dies. You have to push at it. You have to, and they're pushing back at the same time. And you grab a hand, and you have to work hard to chop an arm off. And it stinks, and the ground really does begin to get bloody, and I don't know that rivers of blood run. But there is blood there. It is dispiriting. It is a foul. There is no romance in this business of war. And they knew it better than we do, but times haven't changed. There is no romance in it at all. They are not fluttering wonderful flags at that particular moment. They're preserving their own lives. And at the end of this foul, stinking, meaningless war, probably nobody has gotten another inch of space. What probably happened was the sun went down. And when the sun went down, we were more scared of the dark than we were of each other, because we feared the spirits that roamed at night. And it was a common thing between us that when the dark came, we separated. We didn't fight anymore. We went back to our mead halls, and we felt lousy, because perhaps one, maybe two of our numbers have died. Not a lot, but I knew that one. I loved her. I loved him. And so our community, called the Comitatus, is a bit broken now. There's a hollowness. And besides, that war has stuck its foul breath in. So we come back and we light the fire down the mead hall, and we sit and we eat. It's been a bad day at the office. And there's a silence in the hall, a general grim silence. And then they pass the mead around and we drink it, and that helps a little bit. But, you know, that help is a negative help. It takes away, it doesn't add, doesn't shape. And when we are quiet, then all of a sudden the shop gets up. That's you. That's me. And strikes the lyre. Vroom, which is a... Is that music? Or is that just machinery around here? It's music. That's a lyre. Strikes the lyre. Now, I hope I can do this right so that you get all that I want you to out of this. And the chord struck is not unfamiliar to us. It's familiar. It's happened before. It's happened over and over and over again. And the shop begins to sing. And at first, when the shop sings, what is being sung may be old verses, old songs, things that, like the 23rd Psalm, or like, what was the song? Ken, are you here? Ken Miller. What was the song that we sang Sunday night? Last night? No, Saturday night. Saturday night. No, the very last one. The very last one. Da, da. Now the day is ending. Now the day is over. Okay, that's what the shop is singing. And I say, I know that. And I begin to get a little bit comfortable. You understand? You understand. You all understand. It's like mother singing the same song after a lousy day. And it's mother's voice and the sweetness of it. And all that's relational there is being sung. And so we relax and we offer our trust to that artist. Please don't let go of what I'm talking about. And we shake our heads, and maybe at the very beginning we shiver just a little bit as the emotions rise to the surface that we've been holding down. But as the shop begins to sing deeper and deeper, the same melodies which are familiar, the same figures of speech which are familiar, the same flowers that we have seen over and over and over again, the same knitting and so forth and so on, what is the shop singing about? You know that dirty little day that we have just lived through. The shop is singing that foul day, and the shop is reshaping the day. It's taking details that we remember happened on the battlefield and reweaving them in such a way that they come with order, purpose, nobility. This friend of mine who has died is named and honored and eulogized, given a good word, and so fixed in the whole process of our art. There dwells my friend now, though dead. And some of the gestures that were foul, just hacking and lousy, are elevated and lifted. I'm just telling you what was. I do not mean to imply that therefore we should elevate war, please. I hope that you see this as an analog for what happens day after day for human beings. And what the artist is so sensitive to are the very details. This is the material that we come upon. The very details that the people who listen have experienced, but they experienced it in meaninglessness, in brokenness, in threat, and in fear. Yet as the shop takes them, they begin to find their place in an ordered universe. And that may mean confession, accusation, where there is war, and so forth and so on. But it also means, in the vast, most beautiful sense of that word, redemption. Dear people, this is what we do. We sing a lousy day better. We sing a broken day healed. We sing a broken person whole again. And we don't change. We do not abolish what happened. We shape it. But we shape it, I hope, not only, as we will talk tomorrow, according to our craft, but according to our faith. This is how God enters experience. I think we do an extraordinary thing. I don't have the time, because I have one or two other major things I want to... I would have read to you from a book by John Gardner called Grendel, in which he describes what the shop does in other terms than I did just now. And you have some sense if you want to check that out or read it or whatever. It is in the library. I did check it, although you ought to read the whole book. There's a wonderful passage in there where the shaper, he calls him the lyre scratcher, the string scratcher, not only sings about the people who are listening and gives them as a people a name and a history, but he also sings, and this is so wonderful. Gardner was not known as a Christian, but I think he was becoming one. That shaper sings the creation of the world. And Grendel, who is the beast on the outside, weeps and pleads mercy because Grendel feels that he is not included in this. Or when the shaper gets to sing about the two brothers who killed the other, Cain and Abel, Grendel begins to fear he is Cain. It's powerful. This is what we do. We are the shapers. This is so important. And you don't have to know it. It's just wonderful to sit here at a moment and think of how profoundly influential and effective is that thing which we do. And also how profoundly dangerous if the shape which we give it is dead-end and dangerous. I mean, dead-end and accusatory and the ripping up of other people. I have, as an author, a vendetta with certain authors whose shape is shapelessness, and who end at no meaning at all and have this potent ability to persuade people of nothing. We are nothing. Did I make sense? Do you know what I mean now when I say the shaper? You remember your mother singing? How many of you had parents who told stories when you were children? Those parents were artists. How many of you tell stories to children? You are artists. I just said what you did, and children are so sweetly vulnerable unto the shape. What you tell them, they never forget. You remember the stories that were told, but I don't just mean the details of the story. I mean the world which that story depicted was a real world. And if I would go back to the people of that Mead Hall a year later, after that dirty little war, and I said, tell me about such and such a day when you fought such and such a Mead Hall on the other side of the valley. Which of the two histories will they tell me? The foul and filthy, dirty, bloody, meaningless one? No. They will sing me the song the Shaper sang. Now you tell me, will they be telling me the truth? Yes. Yes. Because upon the Shaper's song, they continue forward and are themselves as a people as well as individuals. This is what happens when you tell children stories. They are shaped. It's very important. I take seriously the thing that we do. We are the shapers. And not unrelated to that is we are the namers. W.H. Auden. I really like talking this stuff to you. This is such a pleasure. Auden once referring to the relationship between poetry and emotion. Let me read you this entire short paragraph. It's about six lines. It says, as to poetry's relation to emotion, he once suggested that there were two theories about this. According to the first, poetry is a means of inducing desirable emotions and repelling undesirable ones. That's what I would have called the ennoblement or the elevation early on. According to the second theory, it is, as he put it, quote, now listen carefully, a game of knowledge, a bringing to consciousness by naming them of emotions and their hidden relationships. It was undoubtedly the second theory which he himself held, and likewise myself. This is what we do in all of our art, is that we name those things that for some of the people maybe never had named before, and therefore may never have been recognized before. Now this is where we come closest to God. When God created the world, God spoke twice, not once, twice. The first word was the ex nihilo creator word, the creation from nothing. It was, let there be light. And then as we understand it, that word itself did not call forth a whole new substance. That word itself was the light. It's a marvel. This is the Hebraic way of understanding that. However God said, let there be light, if we could, like little children now, actually picture it happen, it would be as though we saw the light to flow from God's mouth, because the light and the word were one. John recognizes that in the New Testament. Yes? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. And a little bit later on, the Word was both light, and that light was the life of all humanity. All right? That's what I cannot do. I am not God. If I ever pretend to do that, I have fallen into, I think, a sinful relationship to God. But the second word God spoke was naming. Everything that God created with that first cracking word, God named thereafter. The light was called what? Day, and the darkness was called night, and the firmament was called heavens, and the dry land, and the gathered waters. Isn't that wonderful? See, God spoke twice. Now, what I'm going to tell you, and I, because of shortness of time, I'll only be able to go over it quickly. You should know I got it from Gerhard von Rath in his exposition of the book of Genesis. He described what the Hebrew people understood naming to do, particularly when God gave the name. Three things. Isn't that wonderful? When I say one, two, three, then you say, well, okay, one. I'm going to put, you can take notes on one, two, three. Three things they perceived God, enormous things, and I will never communicate to you the vastness of these things. But the first is touched upon by W.H. Auden. I'm not even sure Auden was aware of this. To name something brought it from the depth of darkness, from that place where we as human beings are not conscious of it, even though we may live with it and it may be a part of it, to bring it from dark into that area where we may apprehend it. When God named something, are there two P's in apprehend? God made it possible for us to apprehend that thing. When you remember Jacob wrestling with the angel all night long. There came an angel and wrestled with him all night long. And do you remember that there was this quick exchange about names? Do you remember that Jacob wanted the name of the angel, perceiving perhaps that it was a night spirit? And that as soon as Jacob would have the name of the night spirit, then suddenly Jacob would have earned or learned some power over it to use the name. This is the fear there. And so the night spirit gives no name at all, but says, "What is your name?" And we find out this is God doing something to Jacob. This is God, in fact, naming Jacob. And naming Jacob what? Israel. And in effect, changing Jacob's character or calling into consciousness that which had lurked but never been there before. So that the one who had been the cheater, Jacob, the one who had been the trickster, becomes suddenly the one who wrestles with God, or not just wrestles, there are other words, or struggles with God. Struggles with, and that doesn't just mean struggles against God, ante God, but it means struggles on the side of God as well, and prevails. All right, so that naming makes it possible to apprehend it. You can know what you didn't know before. Very, very quickly, some of you who are artists have recognized that you have said something or you have done something and somebody came up and said, "I knew that, but I didn't know it like that before, and I can talk about it." There's a kind of an apprehension, a grabbing hold of now by the Spirit. The second thing that God's naming of things does is to establish relationship between it and everything else that is created. Now, I can say that briefly, but I have just told you an enormous thing. Day, night. Light, dark, or suddenly day, night, and suddenly there's a whole business of relationship between there, how they relate to one another. And when God is naming all things and establishing relationship, the end of this vast, almost measureless number of relationships, things to things to things to things, the end of it is order, not chaos, but order. The third thing, all right, so we have apprehension for the first. For the second, I would call it calm, in the oldest sense of this word, comprehension, a gathering together. The third thing that God's naming of something did was to both establish and to effect, to cause, the purpose for that thing, why it existed. Nothing was without reason, without purpose. All these are very interrelated, obviously, because purpose will always have to do with relationship as well. But the naming of something establishes the relationship, and in that name is contained also the why this thing exists. I'm saying something very important. I wish I could say it in such a way that you would be bowled over. But the naming of the thing gave it its reason to be, its value, its worth. And when the thing which was named was also self-conscious, she or he knew his or her value and worth and why she was. Be fruitful and multiply and cover the earth. Have dominion over the lands and the seas. Dress, till, and keep the garden. I never understood until I was older and an artist. What was the beauty of that part of the story where God says to humankind, "Now you, I want you to name the animals." What a blessed power God was giving unto us. I want you to name the animals. I want you now to turn back and look at all the rest of creation, and this is how you participate with me in creation. No, you do not bring something out of nothing. But you name the something that had never been known before. And when you name it, you make it possible for it to be known. And you establish it in holy, blessed, and ordered relationship with everything else. You are to keep the order good. And you declare its purpose. And you make it begin to effect its purpose. My word here, underneath number three, is extension. These are my own words. I never found them anywhere else. So apprehension, comprehension, extension. And this is in time. It begins to move in time. This is in space. Isn't that wonderful how that works out? This is really, I'm Greeking the Hebrew concept right now. But when you name something, you first of all, you identify it, then you put it in space in relation to all other things, and then you move it through time by its relationship and by its purpose. And then, but among the animals, I will quote, "But among the animals there was not found one fit for Adam, And so when two human beings come together by a gift of God, I think that's the business of Adam falling into a deep sleep. This is not something Adam has anything to do with. And neither Adam nor Eve can take any blessing from the fact that community exists. But we're talking about community. When the two come together, what's the first thing that happens? And now I will kick this whole glorious issue of naming up one notch. Adam says, "Hey, at last, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh," and then he names her. And he names her Isha, for she came from Ish, he says. In effect, what we have here is a pun, that neither one is complete without the other. Isha, Ish. Isha has as its core word Ish, but Ish is not complete until it is Isha. Community, that we human beings may name each other. And then what is one of the first acts that Eve does after the poor people are driven out of the garden? Names Cain and Abel, and the process goes on. Now look what it is given unto us to do, dear artists. When in my art, or in my parenthood, or in my friendship to you, well, I shouldn't say or. Always in my art, I name things. I name your experiences. Or better than that, I name you, which I do. My art becomes the naming. I make it possible for you to apprehend things that existed, but that perhaps you never knew before, nor knew so well. That's a kind of a teaching, but it's much more than doctrine. It has to do with the whole of existence. I establish order between you and these things. I don't establish. I declare it. God establishes. I declare it. I reveal it. And I say, I whisper in the most profound and sweet ways, and you are so important. Without night, day is not what day ought to be. And without you, the wholeness of this community has lost vitality. Now, I have to be careful. My art is the naming. But not when it sits between covers in a book and nobody reads it. When you enter into my story and experience it, see, that's the second part of my artistic definition. When you experience, that experience is itself the naming that you carry away thereafter. And I have done the creative act that God has given me to do when it works. And that's why, by the way, I don't mind sometimes even inching towards sentimentality. That's the invitation that draws you in, and it draws from you the assent, the affirmation. Example. There's so much more to say. I hope now you can take all this stuff, won't you? And as you walk the trail, squeeze it, so that it drips fine juice farther and farther and farther. Our youngest daughter is named Talitha. It just happens to work out really neatly because what I'm going to tell you has something to do with arising. Damsel, arise. In a certain sense, arising from the dead. In another sense, not really. Talitha was adopted when she was 8 months old. And they said there was a very swift adoption. Than had written a letter to the agency. We'd already adopted Matthew, and so we had a good relationship with the agency. And Talitha, Matthew is biracial or black, Talitha is biracial or black, and they wanted to be very careful about placement, but she had just come up. I mean, even though they had been working with her genetic mother and grandparents for some time, all the way since before the birth, only just now did the grandparents and the parent decide that they could not raise this child and they had to give it up for adoption. And so Than wrote, and 3 days later we got a call, 3 days? A telephone call said, "Well, we have a child for you. You want to come and get it?" Whoa, that's fast to be pregnant. But I only have a little time, so I'll speed the story up. they were afraid because they did not want to put her in a foster home because she was already knowing, we don't know what her name was then, we don't know what happened to her then, but she was already apprehending those things. She was becoming aware of them. And they didn't, it would hurt her to move her from home to home to home, finally. And so that's why they were so swift and why they saw our letter as an immediate solution to something. So within 2 weeks or so, we drove up there and they took us. The man's name, this is Indianapolis, and the man's name was Ted Michelon, who was the head of the agency. He was a relatively short man and had a propensity to weep. at wonderful moments all the time. He would just cry, and he welcomed us, and he took us back in the agency's building in Indianapolis to a very small room that first looked unfurnished to me, and then he stood back and he started crying, so I figured the child must be in here somewhere. And he did. He was just, he just wept. He is such a wonderful angel to have around there, kind of identifying the time. This is a time for weeping. Well, there she was, behind the door in a crib, sleeping on her back, Talitha. Beautiful child. Beautiful butterscotch-colored skin. Long, luxuriant eyelashes. Her eyes were closed. They were huge eyes and closed. And a little cupid bow mouth, which is partly open because she had nasal. She had a little soft snore. She had a horse snore so soft you could take little pink bows and tie her snores up. You could send them out to people, you know, for baptism. Come, this is the child we're going to baptize. See that snore? She was doing this little song, and she just struck my heart lying there. Little body, head shaped like a light bulb. Smooth light bulb, big dome forehead and head come down to a little neck like this. And somebody had taken a marker and scribbled hair on top of it. I went over to the crib where she was, and I put my face over the crib. It was like, you know, the beauty calls. And I leaned over her, and I got down closer and closer. In those days, my glasses had great big black frames, and in those days I had a great big mustache. And I don't know how, I was maybe this far from her face, looking at this beautiful child, and her eyes opened up. And then they saw this enormous head open, and they opened up very wide, and then that cute little cupid's bow mouth opened up, and she screamed. She shrieked in my face, and I jumped back where Michael and started crying faster and faster. Talitha didn't stop screaming. She screamed in her crib like that, and I watched her eyes go from person to person in the room, and my poor heart broke for her, because I think I know what she was doing. Maybe not. How can one? But I thought she was looking for the familiar face, you know, from 8 months old, and it wasn't there. I think that she was. I think that she would have recognized a grandma and a mother, and she just cried and cried. So, you know, and then I want to cry, and Michelon's over there below, and Than went to Talitha and picked her up, and the child clung to Than with her legs around her stomach as tightly as she could, and that's what calmed her. That's where she stopped and went down to sniffle and sob, and so we drove her home. I tell you about that because that's the way it was for me and Talitha. For several months, anytime I came near her, her eyes would go very wide and she would start to scream. She was a very passive child, and that means that she initiated nothing. She would cling to Than. She always would watch where Than was. She would go to women who were soft and large and loved, but men with mustaches. And I don't know if that was my mustache. You see, I didn't know what was in my child's mind, and there's so much I wanted to be in my child's mind. I don't know what was in her 8 months experience. And already your heart leaps out to love the thing that you do not fully understand. Yes. Yeah. And I didn't know why she liked, was it feet? No, what was it then? Oh, body, certain body part. Well, yeah. Large, soft women. Well, the hug, I think. But it seemed to, my mother. Grandmother, she took immediately to Grandma Wandren. Yeah. Which all said that there's something in the child's past. But you know, I'm recognizing as a parent something in the child's future as well. She's going to need to know that she's not white in this society. She's going to need to know that she's black. And I'm already thinking this, and I'm saying to myself, how shall I speak to the child who will not let me come near her? And how shall I find out what's in her mind? There was a moment when she was in the bathroom standing butt naked, back toward the toilet like this, and she stepped backward and her butt touched the porcelain, the cold porcelain. She leaped away from the porcelain and she screamed like she had been burned. And I wondered, does this, you know, maybe that's just a childish response, or does that mean something from her past? She is an enigma to me. She is a mystery. And somehow or other, there needs to be that kind of communication between her. Now, I'm going to say it because I don't have all the time. So that I could name my child. So that I could name her in all the senses that I've talked about now. And I couldn't. Oh, she could cry well. I understood that in our little church at Grace. She could cry so that liquid came from every hole in her head. Drool from her mouth. Tears from her. When she cried, I might as well have stopped preaching. Because then everybody looked at Talitha, not me. One day, sitting at supper table, I sat at this end, Talitha sat at that end in a high chair with oatmeal on her light bulb head. She happened to glance over me, and I was, let me say this real briefly. I'll just stick this in. Part of what it means to be the artist I'll pick up tomorrow is to watch so closely those who ought to hear you until you realize the power and the significance of gesture and their language, which is what I had been doing for months, watching Talitha. You see, as a parent, it is not just my job to teach Talitha my language. It is my job to discover hers. Very important. And in that moment, she looked over at me. And my beautiful daughter with oatmeal on her head did this. She did this. She went. Her eyebrows went up and down. And I did this back to her. I went. My eyebrows went up and down back. And then her eyebrows went up and down faster. And this was Talitha's language. Eyebrow language. She could talk with eyebrows. She was fluent in eyebrow. She said so many wonderful, we said jokes to each other, truly. I mean, this sounds a bit exaggerating, but you know what I'm talking about. She said jokes about supper with her eyebrows, and I laughed, and I said jokes back with my eyebrows, and she laughed. She smiled. We were talking. We were talking to one another, do you understand? I said, pass the salt in eyebrow. I said, in eyebrow, I said, I love you. She heard me. And so I could begin by walking from her language into mine, to talk to her, to name her. We called Joseph Vanilla. We called Matthew Chocolate. I did sometimes. Called Mary Strawberry, because he had real red cheeks. Called Talitha Butterscotch. Said, my adopted child, said that word, adopted. Said, my adopted child at happy times. Naming, all the time. The parent must be artist. In all the ways I've been talking, naming that child.